Vegas Bad Boy of Podcasting is an entertainment-based wrestling program. The opinions shared are that of the host and their guest. Some celebrity voices are impersonated and usually not well. This program is not intended for kids and certain adults. Listener's discretion is advised. You have been warned. Now let's get ready to podcast. Welcome to another edition of Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting. I got some of the bad boys here with me. Sin City Steve, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing today?
We're good and good and good. And Matt Michaels.
I feel brave, as in brave-hearted.
Okay. I think I get that reference. We have on our phone a special guest who is a pro wrestler, MMA and BJJ fighter. He also is a stunt online coach. He's Scottish born, but Las Vegas based. Vegas Bad Boy welcomes Carter McCall. How you doing, man? Awesome.
I'm good. Just broke out. Came from Scotland straight here to Vegas. Not really.
Oh.
Speaking of Scotland, so what was it like growing up over there? Is Scotland, let's put it this way, is it a different mentality, a different culture than growing up in America, or what you would perceive of growing up in America?
It was cold as fuck. Like, super cold. Like, if it hits like 30 degrees outside, we're taking our shirts off, we're trying to get tanned, like that's hot to us. So, honestly, growing up culture-wise, the UK is a lot like America. So a lot of TV shows, a lot of movies and music, it's the exact same. So culturally, it's not too different in modern age. There are some things. There are some things. Scottish people have a little tendency to be a little bit more quick to anger. But apart from that, it's a very laid-back culture, not too different from the United States.
And what's the? I've never known this, and I've always been curious. What's the drinking age in Scotland?
18. But you know, the common age is probably about 12 or 13.
Uh-huh. And is it, like at family gatherings and stuff, is it pretty common where, because I know my roots are Serbian, so I know when I was like 4 or 5 years old, the old men would say, come here. And they'd give me this little glass, drink. And I'd take a shot of it, and I would just, you know, die burning and eyes like watering, and it's like, you know, pure alcohol. And they're just laughing their asses off because they're, you know, making a kid not know he's drinking alcohol. Is that culture there the same kind of thing where it's like, you know, hey, drinking's just, it's just drinking, family events, it's fun, and we have a good time?
You know what? There's definitely a different attitude towards alcohol. I find outside the U.S., the attitude towards alcohol seems to be a lot more relaxed. Yeah. Like at family gatherings, it's not unheard of for the kids to, you know, get snuck like half a glass of something, you know. Improvise. It's not a big, no one's giving them like shots and, you know, fist stomping them. It's not that kind of vibe. But yeah, it's pretty common. It's pretty common. Not as sinister as you make it seem. But yeah, I would say pretty common.
And what got you into doing MMA?
You know what? Like I said, Scottish people have a stereotype to be quick to anger. So there tends to be a culture of, I don't want to say violence. I don't want to make it out to seem like this battlefield. But there's definitely a culture of violence over there. So the prospect of going out and getting into a fist fight, being at like a club or a bar, is a very, very real thing. Right. So when I was a teenager, the reality hit me. It was like, hey, you're going to be an adult soon. You're going to be going out. you might need to know how to fight. So I was already a fan of the UFC at this point. This was in 2004, and I saw just like a local kickboxing place. I went. It was pretty lame. Nothing really came of it. But then I stumbled across like a Hoist Gracie school. And me being a teenager, I thought it was like the coolest thing ever that Hoist Gracie was teaching, and I could go along and learn. But my dumbass doesn't realize it was a Hoist Gracie affiliate, and it was some dude that wasn't Hoist Gracie teaching. But, you know, jiu-jitsu was an amazing art, so that was when I got my first experience in martial arts and self-defense. Ultimately, it was just one, learn how to defend myself, you know, because that reality is a bit different, you know, that reality of going out there and maybe you do get punched for no reason. That's a thing, you know? Right. So there is that.
And you grew up a pro wrestling fan. What did you gravitate about pro wrestling, and what were your earliest memories of wrestling?
My earliest memories, I was born in late 88. So the world of sport was still on TV. So I was told that when I was like super young, I would get excited when wrestling was on TV and it would like pad the screen. But to be honest, that could have been anything. But I remember SummerSlam 92. Mm-hmm, SummerSlam 92, and it was the whole show. There was so many like characters and moments that to captivate a kid. Like the Road Warriors coming down on the motorcycles at Wembley was just nuts.
Yeah,
seeing the Undertaker come out with like the hearse and the Vulture, the Warrior, seeing Shawn and Rick Martel in the blindfold match, Brett and David. Like the whole show was just really captivating. But again, I was really young. The first real memory I have of wrestling is SummerSlam 96 with Shawn and Vader. You had Mankind and Undertaker in the Boiler Room match.
Yep.
And then you had the opener with Owen Hart and Savio Vega. Yep. Just, you know, like, looking back, it was a decent show, but as a kid, I fucking loved it. Owen Hart, Savio Vega was a great opener. I still go back and watch that to this day. The Boiler Room Brawl was just such a classic match. And, of course, like, the turn with Paul Bearer turning on Undertaker, it was just mind-blowing stuff. And then Shawn and Vader was good. Watching back now, I have a completely different appreciation for it. But, you know, just all those things combined, that was what got me hooked with SummerSlam 96.
Do you look at a show like that and go, you know, the storytelling was something that you want to strive to do today? Because there's so much flipping and flying and, you know, and matches, especially when you're on the indie scene. You get booked on a match here, you get booked on a match there, and there's not a lot of build-up or story to it. You have to tell it in the ring. Does looking at something like a SummerSlam 96 give you a good, you know, guideline or just kind of like a reminder of, hey, when I get into the ring, this is what we're looking? Especially like an Owen and Savio, man. Those two are just, you know, two of the best storytellers around at that time.
Oh, that whole match was genius. Just to sidetrack on that one for a second, but the whole match, Owen, like, Savio starts kicking Owen's ass. It's looking bad for Owen. But, of course, Owen at the time had a cast on.
Right.
But, of course, what he hadn't done yet was he slips off the cast. There's a double down. Owen slips off the cast. When he gets back up, Savio turns him around, Owen clucks him with the cast, turns his back to the ref, and he gets up and slips it on. The camera just captures it perfectly, captures the story. And that, to me, is just such a beautifully vivid display of storytelling.
Yeah.
And I completely agree. I feel like on the independent scene, it's really hard because you know what you're supposed to try and achieve. You're trying to achieve these kind of moments. But without TV and a good 6 to 12 weeks of build, that's going to be hard to get across. So a lot of times what I find on independence is you'll have what I call like these exhibition type matches.
Right.
It's A versus B, C versus D, and then maybe that rematch from the other time.
Right.
And it's just like matches where you can't really delve too deeply on the storytelling because it's going to be missed on an audience who hasn't been watching you guys for like a couple of weeks. So you have to do these matches, which are a little bit more flash over substance, which I get, which I get, it's just frustrating because I'm, as a performer, I'm not one of those guys who's like a million moves a match. Right. I do try and build things up, but at the same time, I understand the constraints we're working with. The people, we can't really play a story because, you know, we don't have that platform. But that's just one of the problems of being like an independent wrestler. Once the whole idea is you get to that stage and then you're able to tell those kind of stories.
Right.
Definitely. And so obviously we had just mentioned SummerSlam being kind of the catalyst to get you excited about pro wrestling. So fast forward just a little bit. When you decided, hey, I want to do this, what did that process entail? How did you get into the business? All that kind of fun stuff.
Oof, that was a complete fluke. I was 13 years old. I was in the midst of my rocker phase. Had long hair. I was like a fucking 100 pounds soaking wet. thinking I was going to be this god guitarist, when in reality, I fucking sucked. I was talking to my high school friend, and I didn't know at the time because he kayfabed me on it, but he was actually training to be a pro wrestler. And I had no idea at the time because I didn't know that anything like that in the U.S. even existed at the time.
Right.
This was 2003. So I find out from him, ask him, can I come along? We get going, and it just so happens I stumble upon like almost like one of the building blocks of like the UK independent wrestling scene of today. Like the first day I walk in there, I think Wolfgang from like NXT UK, he's like 3 months into training.
Wow.
Drew McIntyre, yep, was Drew Galloway back then, was showing me my first couple of bumps. Yep. Lionheart was there. Like the whole genesis of like the modern revival of UK wrestling was pretty much just starting out right there. And so I was kind of lucky that I got to go in at that kind of ground level. I mean, there was pluses and negatives about breaking into the UK scene at that time period, but overall it was a pretty positive experience. I would say the negatives were we were literally learning from the ground up. The UK didn't really have a scene at that time, so there was no one around to teach us. The US has always been lucky in that you guys have generation to generation to generation of pro wrestlers to pass on the art.
Right.
But once the world of sport died in the 80s, just the whole scene dies out. So you don't really have anyone to really carry it on for the 90s. And then barely into the 2000s, it starts to pick up. But what happened is you've got guys in the early 2000s like Wolfgang, Lionheart, Drew Galloway, McIntyre. You've got guys like that who are watching like ECW, ROH, CZW tapes, picking up moves just by looking at them and then replicating them with a little bit of training they had. But of course, no one's there teaching psychology. So, you know, like this all has to just be a long, painful process. But, you know, it's just really interesting to see where it is now. But to see it back then, oof, pretty scary.
So with that then, how does your journey go into MMA and then into pro wrestling? What was your you know, overall mindset? Did you know that you wanted to do one or the other, or did you think that doing both would benefit you in the end? How did it come about?
Well, I guess going on that timeline, so I've been a childhood fan of pro wrestling, and I decided to try and get into it once I found out that training was an option. So I guess, like I said, I was also a fan of UFC at the time, and growing up, I wanted to learn some self-defense, so I started to get into martial arts. Started doing jiu-jitsu, started doing Muay Thai, started doing boxing. So, you know, I'm kind of doing these things simultaneously, but ultimately in my heart, I'm wanting to be a pro wrestler, because I'm still wrestling at the time, I'm still making towns on the weekend, I was doing that kind of thing. But here's the thing, from my first run in wrestling from the time I started, which was when I was 14, up until I was 20, I sucked so badly. Like I just didn't get it. Like I can look back objectively and say I didn't get it because, you know, like I was saying, we didn't have any mentors,
right,
or anything to pass on those invaluable bits of knowledge. And if you don't have that, it's going to take a hell of a long time to get to you. And I just didn't get it for that first time. Like, I would go out, I would do matches with a very simplified structure, if I didn't understand any sort of deviance from it, I would go and just hit generic moves, and that would be it. It was a very basic formulaic plan. I didn't understand like why crowds wouldn't react to certain things, or why when I do this here, it's not appropriate. I completely didn't get it. So I found myself getting more frustrated the more time I spent on the pro wrestling scene. Plus, the wrestling scene at the time was different as well. It's to say it's 2010 at this point. I've been on the scene for about the better part of 6 years. To get signed in the UK at that point, you still had to be like the 6'4", 275-pound, like, absolute Greek god of a guy.
Yeah.
And you know what? No matter how hard I train, I'm never going to be that tall, and my body frame can't hold that much muscle, so it's not going to happen.
Right.
So at the time, MMA was starting to get big, and I was like, you know what? If I'm going to put my eggs in one basket, I probably should put them in the MMA. Because at the time, even though I was wrestling, I'd had two or three MMA fights. I'd won all three, so I was feeling pretty good about them. And I was like, well, do I commit to wrestling or do I commit to MMA? And at the time, I was like, well, I'm never going to get signed being this small. I'll go into MMA. And that's where I dedicated my focus. I stopped doing shows, and I put all my eggs into that basket, which, you know, I don't regret, because I wasn't really going anywhere in wrestling at that point anyway, because I didn't get it. But, yeah, put all my eggs in that basket in MMA, did not regret it. It actually led to me moving to the U.S. in 2011. So, you know, if I hadn't have committed to MMA full-time, I wouldn't have ended up taking the leap and moving here for the hopes of better training and better training partners.
And you moved to California, is that correct?
Yeah, I moved. I was a complete stereotype and moved straight to Hollywood. Because obviously, why wouldn't you?
And you, you know, in doing so, did you have at that point any idea of, while you were doing the MMA, what you would do maybe if you needed extra cash? Did something like doing stunt work kind of, you know, cross your mind?
You know what? Definitely, like, bro, when I got here, I was thinking of everything. Because it took, from the time I landed till I got my actual paperwork that I could actually work here, it took me about 6 to 8 weeks. So that's a long time, and yeah, my money was running down fast because it didn't come over here with a lot of savings. So once, before I had that, I was like, shit, what can I do? I was thinking about gardening. I was thinking about playing a guitar on Santa Monica Boulevard, like fucking anything. And yeah, you think of stunt work, but to get in the stunt work is such a hard thing. Like, if you think pro wrestling is a hard industry to break into, wait till you get to Hollywood. Like,
right,
the stunt industry is so tight. Like, the stunt coordinator has done this for, like, the past 30 years, and all his guys, he's known for, like, 15. And then maybe they've got, like, a few juniors who've been around for 5 years. Like, they all know each other. It's super hard to break into unless you've got something very specific that they're looking for,
right,
or like a skill. And I was just so lucky that I had like someone, a casting agent, happened to stumble upon me when they were looking for an MMA fighter to do some stunt work in 2014. But that was sheer luck, absolute luck.
That's usually how it goes too. I mean, anything that I've ever gotten in Hollywood has always been just dumb fucking luck. And you just you just happen to have that skill or that certain thing they're looking for at the moment, and you just bump into it.
It was the most Hollywood shit ever. I just had an MMA fight on the Saturday night, and on the Monday morning, I was in the gym. I was just losing like a really light like weight workout, like 10 in the morning, and I get a call from the manager of the MMA gym that I go to, and they call me up and they're like, "Hey, where are you?" I'm like, "Oh, you know, I'm just resting after fight week." Like, "Oh, there's a casting agent here. They want to know if you'd be interested." And blah, blah, blah. "They're looking for this MMA fighter. If it kind of fits your description, would you be interested?" And when they told me about that, I thought it was just some bullshit college project that some dude's going to pay me $50 for.
Right.
And he was like, oh, it's actually for audience. It's Kingdom. And I was like, oh, shit. Yep, I'll meet him. So and end up meeting him that night at a Starbucks on Sunset in La Brea.
Yeah.
Like the most Hollywood shit ever. Go in there, meet this dude, and he's like, yep, you're exactly what we're looking for. Here's what we're looking for. Here's the schedule. Here's the pay. Are you interested? And when he said, here's the pay, like, fucking hell, my mouth probably dropped. That was it. He probably just looked at me and thought, yep, got him.
And, you know, with that, what was your first experience then like being on a set for the, you know, first time where it's a big production?
You know, looking back, I wish I would have handled it differently. Not saying I was a prima donna, but it's just like pro wrestling. There's like there's an etiquette, and I didn't understand it. And there's a few times I got chewed out here and there over the space of filming because I just didn't understand things. Like all the directors and the like the APs have chairs,
right?
And I didn't notice because they weren't sitting there. But like in between takes, I sat down in one of the APs' chairs. Holy fuck, you'd think it was the end of the world. Like, it was such a big deal for him, when in reality, they could have just said, like, oh, hey, you're in my chair, and it wouldn't have been a big deal. But set etiquette being what it is, that's a big thing in their world, I guess. So yeah, there's just, like, little things that would have changed. It's a completely different lifestyle. I didn't anticipate how long the days would be.
Right.
I didn't anticipate how repetitive things would be. But overall, it's an interesting subculture. Like the makeup artists, the techs, they all know each other. They'll work on all these different projects. It's interesting to see how it all comes together. I've never really watched a movie or a TV show the same way after.
Right. Yeah, that's the most interesting thing about it is, especially too, when you tell family and friends that you're doing something like that, and they just don't grasp the concept of what it is in terms of putting it together. It's always like, oh, this is like the most spectacular thing. And it's like, no, it's really, you know, 16-hour days. And, you know, you're doing, like you said, a repetitive nature of things. And it's like, oh, my God, it can get just absolutely crazy and frustrating. Did you find yourself going, I hope to hell that I can, you know, just make it in MMA and be able to, you know, just fight and make that my focus so I can have my gym time, my me time, and my fight time?
You know what? Man, like, I can honestly look back and say, like, my goals when I was in MMA weren't actually that high. Like, looking back now, like, I think I was lucky because I was lucky to train with a lot of very high level names. Like, I trained at Black House MMA. Okay. So I got to do a lot of training with like Anderson Silva, Lyoto Machida, Chinzo Machida, Alan Japan, Khalil Rountree. I got to train with a lot of high level guys who are currently in the UFC, Bellator, World Series of Fighting. So while doing this, you get a really good idea of where you actually stand. And it's like, holy shit, if I had to fight these guys, this would be embarrassing. Like, you just get highlighted on TV. So it kind of made me realize early on, it's like, yeah, I was pretty good, but I'm not, like, best in the world material. So I was like, you know what? I'll try and get to the UFC. I have a few fights, have a good record. And then maybe retire and just open a gym. Like, that was the ultimate goal. Just,
right.
Like, make enough money to open a gym, live a relaxed lifestyle. You know, I'm not too materialistic, but that was definitely in the end game. But I was never like this guy who was like, I'm going to win the welterweight title, then the middleweight title, then go up to light heavyweight and fuck those guys up. I was never that guy. I was always like, you know what, I'll probably have a few fights, do well, maybe lose one or two, whatever, open a gym and just relax away from it. So that was me. I was always kind of low shooting when I was filming. But honestly, I was just hoping, like, fuck, hope someone sees me and wants to actually get me in a real movie, get me some real lines, make some real money.
Right. And so what would be something that our listeners would be surprised to know about Calder McCall?
Oof. Multi-instrumentalist with emphasis on mentalist.
Nice. What, elaborate on that a little bit.
A little bit musically gifted. Play a little bit of guitar, play bass, play drums, play piano. Yeah, I'm almost like a one-man band, but I cannot sing. But I'm only limited to instrumentals.
what kind of genres do you like to play?
Honestly, I have a very wide musical palette. I obviously really enjoy rock. It's very basic. I really like to play around like blues, jazz, especially jazz. I find anything related to jazz, just like the ability, the freedom of it, but also the complexity of it as well, like kind of intrigues me. And it's very free-forming, but it has its own rules as well. I like it. It's very, very hard to explain. It's almost like wrestling in a way. There's rules, but there's not really, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
very
definitely.
Open to the person. So those are what I like to play.
Very cool, man. So yeah, I actually have messed around with, I've been in a couple of bands and things like that a few years back. So yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, except I'm the opposite. I've done vocal work, but I can't play an instrument to save my life. I tried to pick up a guitar and No. So, but yeah, man, that's awesome. Now, as far as your MMA training that you went through, obviously, you know, there was some sizable amount of time that you spent there. What would you say you took from that? Because obviously, you know, you started off with the pro wrestling, you did some MMA, and now you're back in pro wrestling.
You know, coming back into it, I would say a very good thing is, well, actually a couple of good things. Like, I feel like this is true for any athlete, but having a good understanding in sport, like a real background in sport, you kind of understand what it means by like the psychology of athletics, you know, like in a boxing match. Like to me, a wrestling match is kind of similar like a good boxing match, like psychology wise, like is it an even exchange at all times? No, maybe one guy's getting beaten on and then there's a spectacular comeback. Like these dramatic athletic moments, I feel like having a real background kind of gives me a little bit of insight into these moments and how to recreate them. On a physical level, I feel like striking, because I do use a lot of strikes in the matches. And from sparring MMA, like I always consider myself a very considerate partner. Like when you spar me, I'm not usually trying to take your head off. So there's a good degree of control there, you know, like if you say like we're going 25%, we're going 25%, we're going 50%, we're going 50%. But like that level of control, I've been able to like touch someone but not kill them. That's a pretty good skill to have. So when it comes to pro wrestling, I feel like that ability to place my strikes but not put them in has been a very valuable tool to sharpen. I feel like it adds a little bit of realism to it as well, just like a more realistic feel. But then again, you've got some guys who are just going out there and blasting people anyway, so that's an expression.
Yeah, definitely. And so we've talked about this here on the show quite a bit. What do you think about the current state of independent wrestling in the U.S. especially, where it just seems to be a constant game of can you top this with high spots?
You know what? I completely agree, and I feel like it might kind of tack back on to what I was talking about earlier, like being unable to tell full stories. So we're all in this independent boat, trying to get signed, trying to get noticed, trying to get on the big stage. But how do we do that? I can't really send a 17-minute match of mine to a promoter and expect them to watch it. It's just not going to happen. You know, like if you think about how many emails and messages a promoter gets a day, it's not going to happen. So, I mean, how do you do it? I mean, the most easiest way, it seems, is almost do some stupid shit, fall off a ladder on, like, the floor in front of, like, 10 people and have them chant holy shit, and then do it enough times, and then you may get seen by someone. That kind of seems how it is. You're trying to go viral by doing this crazy shit.
Yeah, definitely.
I get it. I get it, but as an independent performer who wants to live into his 50s and 60s and still wants to go to move for a wheelchair,
right.
it's not really the road I want to go down. So I don't know. I think independent wrestling is in a weird state. I don't want to be that old guy who's like, oh, this guy's fallen, but it's a very weird time. I feel like the business is very healthy, but at the same time, the business is doing a lot of weird, weird shit. And I don't know if it's good or if it's different. Yeah, it's very hard to explain.
Yeah, definitely. Go ahead.
No, I was finished.
Oh, okay. One thing that is pretty exciting is it almost feels like as if we're on the verge of another boom period, with all of the all of these promotions popping up and distribution being higher than it ever has been, because of the internet and iPay-per-view and all these different methods of being able to get noticed out there.
It really is. It's really, really promising. And you know what? If you'd have told me 2 years ago there's a boom period, I would have agreed with you as well. It just seems to be getting better and better. My question is where does it go from here? Because we've reached a really good point, and we've got all these promotions vying for all this time. But my big thing is, where does it go from here? If AEW becomes big, okay. Does it become bigger than WWE? What about worldwide? So, there's all these things. I think what the industry needs is for another, megastar. Another Stone Cold, another Rock, someone with that kind of mega power and charisma to come through. And honestly, I don't think there's been a person since Austin Rock that's had that kind of ability. No offense to Cena. I think Cena is one of the best of all time. Mm-hmm. But I don't feel like he has that power to drag the common man in. I could go up to someone random in the mall and crotch chop them. And a lot of people are going to know what that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I may get punched, but a lot of people are going to know. Austin's a household name. There hasn't really been anyone since that period who's had that kind of power. So whether that comes from WWE or whether that comes from somewhere else, the industry I feel needs that someone who's going to become a household name. But I think the question is, who's it going to be and how is it going to happen? How do you make someone that relevant in pop culture to make wrestling relevant again,
Yeah, without a doubt, man. So up next, we're just going to do some quick word association. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to name off some names from the business or some promotions. And what I'd like for you to do is just to name off the first thing that comes into your mind. And we're going to do this for about 70 seconds, okay? Are you ready?
Go.
Awesome.
Sin City Steve, 70 deadly seconds starts now.
British Championship Wrestling.
First promotion.
GTS.
CM Punk's move.
Wolfgang.
Old time homie.
Colt Cabana.
Dick.
Anderson Silva.
Cool dude.
Lyoto Machida.
Bad mother, shut your mouth.
Bubblegum.
He's a weirdo.
Worldwide Wrestling League.
Oh, Mike and his fucking bongos.
Ricky Knight.
Legend.
Dr. Kruger.
Good man.
The Decapitator.
Good man.
Empire Wrestling Federation.
OG California promotion.
And last but not least, Bumps and Bruises.
Fun ass up and coming promotion.
He survived.
He did.
He did it.
He did it. Good job, man. Well, we got to ask you, Carter, what are some good social media sites of yours that we can at least keep up with you? Because I'm sure you're going to let us know when you're healthy again and we can find out where to find your next matches.
I'm on all the standard ones. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, on YouTube. Find me at Calder_McCall, McCollL. That's Calder_McCall. On Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter.
Awesome. All right. Well, Calder, man, thanks for spending some time with us, man, and hanging out with us bad boys, and we appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, bad boys.
All right, everyone. Calder McCall.
Vegas, Bad Boys of Podcasting, holding you down since day one, January 2019.
The podcast in the universe.
There's like 1,000 podcasts.
Vegas Bad Boys, day one, say.
Different, thoughts, outrageous,
interview,
exciting,
interesting,
intriguing,
amazing,
funny, intergalastic.
Bad Boys.
If you haven't listened to all of our podcasts, take a listen of what you might have missed. JTG.
Shad and I. Shad was the big guy. Is it the same size? One is a little bit fatter, right?
Yeah.
One is cut. Yeah. One is kind of like pudgy.
Yeah, that's Angelo. Oh,
yeah. Oh, I guess it's kind of similar to me, Shad. Yeah, I'm kind of like the...
Al Snow.
Well, yeah, I did. I actually wrote a book. I also, just so you guys know, I do magic for the blind.
Wow.
My way of giving back to the community, you know, is let me tell you, it's like, is this your card? And it's like, I don't know. And you're like, it is. Ta-da.
Like, oh my God, Jeff Cobb.
You know, I don't plan to wrestle into my late 40s or 50s or 60s or 70s. Like, you know, but, you know, again, I say that now, but.
Right.
it's like the weirdest addiction ever, you know? Like,
yeah, we know. B. Brian Blair.
All of a sudden, I look in the mirror and Terry's, you know, spanking his Woody on top of the back of Coco's ass. Oh. With his pants ripped, and I'm going, oh my gosh, man, we're going to prison.
Vicky Guerrero.
You know, you are definitely, in our minds, a Hall of Famer. Because
I'll give you $5 later, guys.
Phil Landers.
How do you guys do this? Are you guys in like a recording studio, or are you guys in a home studio?
Hey, you don't contact WWE Creative and ask them how they write Raw, do you?
We're
all in a bathroom.
We're in a
right
bathroom. Yeah, we're in a bathhouse. Right, we're
in
all
the bathtub.
You're all in a bathhouse. Yeah.
RVD.
If I hit a squirrel with my car, it would totally ruin my day. I mean, I was like, I'd get out of the car and I'd try to save it, you know. And
Selena De La Renta.
When you say Selena at work, Selena in real life, it's about the same. It's the preparation for my everyday life. It's about the same my preparation for MLW. The only thing is I need twice the amount of makeup and probably tighter dresses. But
Nick Aldis.
I do love Vegas, and you know what's funny is that, like, the first time I went was actually for TNA when I debuted at the main event, Mafia. I'd never been to Vegas before then.
Wow.
But in many ways, it's really the showbiz capital of America.
Yep.
You know, like, there's so much show business going on there all the time. I just love that vibe.
Vegas Bad Boys, a podcast, has over 50 interviews, and they keep on coming. Make sure you subscribe. Keep listening. Write a review about our podcast. Come to our live events. Participate in our contest. Like our social media. And most importantly, tell all your family and friends about us. We're Vegas born, and we are Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting.